100,000 people are meeting in the street with red roses, and with the prison officers described this as not a possibility to be a part of because they can be too emotional influenced.
Hello, and welcome to Locked Up Living, the podcast which looks at resilience in challenging organisations, such as, but not only, prisons and hospitals for mentally ill prisoners and patients. My name is David Jones, and together with Naomi Murphy, I present your Locked Up Living podcast. Knut Sorensen has worked for 28 years in the correctional service in Norway. He was educated and served as a prison officer for 11 years. He started as a teacher at the University College of Norwegian Correction Service. He's also a sociologist and now a PhD candidate in criminology at the University of Oslo. His recent research concerns the effects upon prison staff of working with a very high-profile prisoner, Anders Breivik, as described in his paper, Prison Officers' Coping Strategies in a High-Profile Critical Situation, Imprisonment after the 2011 terrorist attacks in Norway. Good to meet you, Knut.
Good to meet you.
Hi, really glad that you could join us today and really enjoyed your paper actually on prison officers because really a lot of what you've written really resonates from the experiences that you see within the system here. But we're going to talk about the very challenging work you've been doing, and I wonder if first you could tell us a bit about your background and what brought you to doing this research.
I started in the prison service as a prison officer back in 1993 at a low security prison called Vardal prison in Norway here. And my first experience was about actually what we're going to talk about today, emotional labor. With the experience, I was 20 years old, living home with my parents, and suddenly I'm in a position where I had to comfort a man about 50 years old, crying because his alcohol abuse had led to the loss of his contact with his kids. So that was a very demanding and a new understanding of the work of a prison officer I didn't have before I started as an officer. And then serving 3 years at Vardal prison, I served 6 years at a high security prison, Åna prison, Trondheim prison, and Ila detention and security prison, where I also worked in the same prison wing as Breivik, should be detained 8 years later. During these years, I was educated at the University College of Norwegian Correctional Service to be a prison officer, and also studying sociology at the University of Oslo, where I finished a degree of Master in Sociology in 2007. In 2004, I was asked to start as a teacher at the University College of Norwegian Correctional Service, and still works there today with subjects like safety, security in prisons, organization and professionalism among prison officers. That's the short version.
I was really struck there where you spoke about the role when you joined the prison service at age 20 and then finding yourself having to act in kind of a parental role, which is an awful lot of what prison officers end up doing, isn't it? Kind of like acting as almost like older father figures, big brothers, uncles, but how much more challenging it is to be doing that at the age of 20 than it would be if you were doing that at the age of 50, for instance.
Absolutely. If I had my years of experience and background today, it would be I would have more have to tackle it. With 20, I sat there a bit more afraid, just listening, and hopefully be a part of my have to be empathic and just listen to the story. And he thanked me afterwards, but I have no kind of experience to hang it on and to develop the conversation that you can do when we are a bit more experienced than 20 years.
And did your training prepare you for the fact that that would be a big part of the role?
Our training at the college, I have some of the community and communication tools to understand and opening questions and to be a part in a conversation with the different teams in a more professional way than a 20-year-old unexperienced would do. Yeah.
And thank you. And I understand that this particular paper is part of a wider research project that you're undertaking. I wondered if you could tell us a little bit about that and the scope of that.
Yeah. It's the PhD thesis is, contains about four articles about the Breivik imprisonment. All it's about the Breivik imprisonment. Two other articles studies the prison officers, and two studies the prison managers' security arrangements. The first article I wrote was named, it's in Norwegian, but translated to English, it's Breaking the Chain of Command, Routines and Flexibility in Organizing the Imprisonment after the 22nd of July. There it discussed that ILA was not security dimensioned to imprison Breivik at the moment they got him, because they had to have, he had to be detained nearby Oslo. And ILA didn't have that security level, so this was an extraordinary imprisonment for ILA. And they had to establish several new security measures that leaders should implement in the chain of command when you bring it further down in the prison system. But since it takes too much time to go through the chain of command, the leaders informally breaks it and goes directly to the relevant person to know what just do it principle in this critical situation. They also break the chain of command because of because only those who need information shall have it, and establish a formal need to know principle to have all the security arrangements as soon as possible in the organization. The second article I write with Bjørn Ivar Kruke with the University of Stavanger, it's named Securing Insecurity in the Blue Line, Reliability Through Improvisation, a Case of a Temporary Prison Arrangements. And there we discuss similar things, but we discuss how management at ILA, in search for reliability, improvise and loose coupling the structures so that it can centralize work tasks traditionally belonging to example, kitchen personnel, social workers, tasks that are given to the officers instead, who in this imprisonment are seen as the reliable ones, those we trust in this imprisonment, when it's very critical of time and values at stake. Work tasks belonging to the prison officers are also transferred from the prison officers through the prison manager as up in the line in the prison system, because they are seen as even more reliable in the prison manager than the officers. So then they are transferring such work tasks from another professions into the blue line, also the line where the officers are and not the civilians are working in the prison system. They are also getting the officers and the prison managers are getting control of the work. They are above in the rank and can control the work which are flowing, and that was the critical task they had. The third article that I'm writing myself is Security and Reflexivity, Organizational Culture and Security Understanding in a Prison Wing from the 22nd July. The short version is that the article discuss the prison officer's description of the prison officer work at the established especially high security wing to be less relational and caring and rather more distant than influence their reflection and negative in their work. And the fourth article that we are going to discuss today, prison officers coping strategies in a high profile critical situation, where me and my colleague Berit Johnson at the academy seek to understand how prison officers dealt with their emotion in relation to Breivik and how they managed their professional and private lives in this period. And that we're going to talk more about now, I guess.
Yeah. Well, I was really interested when I read the paper to find that the prison had to kind of like create this unit especially for him, and which obviously his crime had massive international visibility, so you can see that it quite an unusual crime in that sense. But it did make me wonder how many prisoners within the Norwegian prison system were subject to those kind of conditions of being somewhat removed from the rest of the prison population, because obviously in Britain there are a reasonable minority of individuals that are subject to that, and I wondered is this just so rare that this is the only person in the Norwegian prison system, or do they just create these spaces when they need to?
At that time it was two prisons in Norway, what we called Skien prison and Ringerike prison, to have these facilities, but they were too far from Oslo, so they had to establish one at Ila too. Today I think it's, if I'm correct, it's only Breivik who's sitting in this especially high security regime, and for the last 10 years I think it's 10 persons have been in this special facilities, so it's very seldom we use this in Norway. They have to have an extra dimension about the threat of escapes or hostage situations to fulfill to do this kind of regime. It's strictly, and that's good.
Yeah. And what's the size of the Norwegian prison population?
Have to guess. I think it's 3,500.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. So I suppose that helps put it in perspective in terms of the size of the UK's prison population. And I was struggling with why we have so many more that might have those kind of circumstances. Yeah. I'm wondering also, obviously, the image of Norwegian prisons is the impression is conveyed that they are a lot safer, or they feel a lot safer for the people that are in them, and so less acting out behavior perhaps, so therefore maybe you wouldn't need these conditions.
We have some studies about that smaller units, we have very small prison if you compare it to England and Wales, so we have also studies that the inmates feel that these small units are better conditions, more we have the research about Norwegian or Nordic exceptionalism, that they are better to be in, and also it's also of course weaknesses, but these small prisons have some good functions too.
So, you know, obviously the killing of 77 people on the 22nd of July 2011 was a tragic event of international significance, which I think everybody watched in shock around the whole world. But the impact on Norway must have been really intense. Why did you want to go back delving into this incident 10 years after it had happened?
In fact, Ila prison had a request to our college in 2015 that they wanted research about the Breivik imprisonment. I got the research and finished the data collection first in 2016. And in 2019, I understood that the research project had the quality to be a PhD. Then I applied to the University of Oslo and started the PhD program. And yeah, working 50% and the time goes by.
But it sounds like the prison system really were really keen to learn from that experience, that they were seeking out that research to try and learn from what had happened.
Yeah, it's a very special imprisonment historically in Norway, so we have a lot to learn about such experience and how it influenced our practices in the Norwegian Correctional Service. Yeah,
I really liked your paper, which incidentally I think was extremely well written in the English. So if you did the translating yourself, congratulations for that. But it was a very powerful paper. And in it, I liked your descriptions of the prison protocols, which were expected, and you stress they were required. And to me, those protocols seem like a distillation of prison protocols. And in a way, you put it as no mistakes and no leaks. And of course, almost all prison work is based upon that, but we see wide variations from it. So despite the insistence on that no mistakes and no leaks protocol, you say that mistakes were almost inevitable. Can you say something about that and what the emotional effect of this was on colleagues?
Yeah, it was strong expectations that Ila shouldn't fail in this imprisonment, and a strong occupational norm of following detailed instruction. It can, in itself, it can lead to anxiety and stresses the prison officer, and that in the stress influences the prison officer to fail in the operating the procedures again. So it became a negative circle in it. But the officer also tried to meet the demands and not to fail with a form of mental relaxation, as one prison officer described, after work, being mentally exhausted, take with him his fishing rod and went out for several hours and said it was quite okay that the fish didn't bite, but I just needed a relaxing break afterward to readjust myself to be to go back to work the day after. So they are trying to reduce the stress and anxiety. One officer actually made a mistake, and he has a quotation giving us an insight in the stress and anxiety. He's saying that, "I made a mistake and reported myself. I reported it formally in the organization and to my manager. I couldn't sleep that night. The management was interested in how this could happen. I think it was an all right way to handle this mistake, but they wouldn't kill me." So they are having a lot of energy and thoughts and influence and a lot of stress during the works that can influence their way in behaving when they are doing the security procedure, which was very detailed.
It's a horrible pressure, isn't it, to be having that, how you manage, you know, all the complex feelings that would arise in relation to that person, and yet not really being able to discuss it and managing to still be professional. So you can totally see how people end up making mistakes, because the more anxious you are, that's much more likely to happen.
Yeah.
It seems like a more heightened version of what happens ordinarily for officers, this pressure, which in the UK, I think prison officers often get a very bad press in terms of how they're perceived by the public, when in fact the job is an incredibly difficult job to do.
Yes. So I was thinking about that, how you may in most prisons have the same kind of basic rules, but the level of tension surrounding them can differ widely according to the circumstances. So in your paper, you mostly focus on the impact on prison staff. So what kind of people were you interviewing? Prison officers, managers, and were they all men?
I interviewed 10 prison managers that had a responsibility for Breivik imprisonment, and 11 prison officers who worked in the wing with Breivik where he was detained. A few of them were women. I have no possibility to analyze the data in relation to sex, because there were so few, maybe a couple from the prison officers and a couple from the prison managers were women. So, men mainly.
Thank you. And what would you say were your main findings from the research that you'd done?
A couple of the prison officers said that this is our job, that's it. I don't bring my work home. They did not experience this work-family conflict, but several other prison officers did. And that's one of the main findings, I will say. I've labeled my findings in two categories. Category 1 is Naughty in My Head, which describe the prison officer's need to avoid or keep distance to emotional impressions from the terror attack that could threaten their professionalism working with Breivik. The examples are the prison officer did not participate in ceremonies about the terrorist attack. We had a ceremony in Norway with the Ceremony of Roses, it is called, and 100,000 people are meeting in the street with red roses and with love conquering hate. And this was the prison officer described this as not a possibility to be a part of because they couldn't be too emotional influenced. But also, one year after, when a prison officer is describing when his wife is going to see the 1 year anniversary of the terrorist attacks on television, and he's saying, if you're going to see that, I'm going for a walk, and she should see that. So yes, he's going for a walk. He wouldn't have that kind of influence in his mind, and that's 1 year after this has happened. So and some of them also say that they did not have any TV or social media about, read about it or going further into to see about the terrorist attack. The second category of finding is out of my head, a coping strategy they used when they already was expressed to emotional demanding impressions. And the examples here are when they are unwillingly exposed from impression for them the terrorist attacks. Some say that they sat maybe on sort of, television at work, and then Breivik is calling on, and then you have to go from the television and straight down to Breivik and have to readjust or reset themselves as they use as expressions. Another one is a prison officer who is out driving, and because of the tunnel is closed when he's driving, he has to drive by Utøya, where the extreme violence happened. This is nearby when the terrorist attacks happened, and he's in a line with the cars. He's driving very slowly and see grown up men lying next to the road crying, which made a huge impression on him, and have to do some mental work because he can't bring such demanding emotion into his work with Breivik. Then he says, then it could have gone wrong. So both the to keep away from the emotional impression, but also when they have the emotional impression in mind, they try to reset, to have a distance to their emotions, so they can be professional with Breivik. So that I will kind of say the coping strategies that are my main findings in this article.
Do you think it's, I mean, I often hear officers say, oh, you know, I leave work at the gate and don't take it home with me, but do you think that's really truly possible? So people, you know, the strategies that people use to try and protect themselves and make sure they're not eaten up by the work, can that mean that they end up disconnected in other ways outside of work? You know, can it put distance between them and their families, or create conflict, or maybe using unhealthy coping strategies to cope?
Yeah, I see some studies about this spillover effect influencing between family and work, some of the over time there are studies about those who are working for many years in the high security establishment that going to be a part of their behavior, the way they are acting as a prison officer, or they also bring back home in child rearing. It's more fathering or mother situations. But I also think that some officers, when this was extreme, then you are more on alert about this. But when you come to more ordinary days, I think many of them try to lay it behind when they close the gate for the day. Positive and maybe also some negative influences for what they're bringing with them of emotional influences, of course.
Yeah, that's very interesting. I like your discussion about emotional labour, mental work, and because I think it comes upon us when we're least expecting it often, and you can never be sure that the demand for that kind of emotional labour has passed. It very much reminded me of a trip that I made. It was the beginning of last year, and I was travelling from Warren Hill, which is a prison on the east coast of England, to Leicester, and I drove past the village of Soham. And you may not know this, but Soham was a village where two little girls were murdered by a man called Huntley, who I'd also met in one of our high security prisons. And so all of this came flooding back to me as I made the journey, and I needed to do some work on that, really. And I suspect that the people you've been talking to will constantly be revisiting their experiences with this man.
Absolutely.
So you mention Isabel Menzies Lythe in your paper, which pleased me. She used to live in Oxford, and I knew her reasonably well. And she wrote a famous paper, which I think you're hinting at, Social Systems as a Defence Against Anxiety, which could have been written about this situation, I think. She suggests that sometimes the systems put in place to protect nurses from the emotional pain of their patient's situation can have unwanted effects, such as high levels of sick leave and unpleasantly distant or cut-off relationships, both at work and at home. Did you come across such developments as this?
Yes. Some officers mentioned that they work, because of all the security arrangements and procedure they do, not discuss that 22nd of July when everybody else did. They have a handling on it. The officers feel that they have to choose it away, all this emotional work, because they have to focus on the role, and they are left with a more strict emotional regime, and they usually want to have the want to discuss it, but because of the regulation, and that's maybe one of those unwanted effects that she's writing about. In another article of the prison officers, also label the detailed security procedures they do as mechanical work, and a different understanding of the work role that traditionally are more relational, caring, so that also this detailed security procedures are this is mechanical. He is more an object. He's not a kind of to be in relation with. The also, since the role is a bit, what do you use the word? They are not that familiar to in operating in such a way.
So, Naomi, should I ask the next question, you the final one? So, Knut, I sometimes think of prisons being the places where a community or state invest their fears and anxieties, and sometimes these can be very concrete. For example, you mentioned that if something had gone wrong, there was the potential of a government collapse. 10 years later, do you think there is the same level of anxiety around?
Right after the terror attack, one report criticized the government for their crisis management the 22nd of July. If Breivik had succeeded to escape, that he had written in his manifest to do, today or earlier in his imprisonment, I think that would have been at least it would have been consequences for the Minister of Justice in Norway, especially if Breivik had managed to murder or injure people that he has said he wanted to do, according to a death list he had written. So yes, according to what Breivik then his eventual escape, I think that the anxiety level is still high, was even higher, of course, straight after. But Breivik is such a massive case and terrorist attack and the imprisonment, so that it would have even today had consequences, I think, yes.
Just shows how much ends up riding on these things, doesn't it? Because human error is inevitable at some points, and not necessarily in his case, but there's always that possibility of human error. And I think people working within the criminal justice system, certainly I think within Britain, you really see that level of fear of stepping a foot wrong and then experiencing a punitive response as a consequence of that. So I think it makes people very frightened for fear of finding themselves on a harsh reprimand of some sort, you know, losing their job or what have you. This must have been very painful work to do. How did you prepare yourself and look after yourself throughout? Did you have supervision?
In opposition to the prison officer, I had the possibility to be a part of Norway's grieving process since the 4 or 5 years before I started these interviews with the prison officer and prison managers at ILA. Anyway, I found it emotionally challenging, especially in some cases and some quotations when the prison officers are describing, etc., the grown-up men crying next to the road. We're told about it, linkage, all this, what they are telling about to the Utøya situation when we sat there on the 22nd of July, and I heard about the bombings in Oslo, and then the messages about the shootings at Utøya coming. Then the feelings are connecting and being difficult, and it's hard. But in this case, I think no, I had no supervisor and think that was okay. But if I should have done this study closely to a terrorist attack, I probably would have appreciated a supervisor. It's an emotionally demanding field to do research about. So if that had been the setting for me to going out straight after the terrorist attack, I would have appreciated a supervisor, yeah.
And in your work, did you identify things that would be useful to happen in the future to alleviate the emotional burden on prison officers?
Some of the prison officers had emotional supervision with psychologists, but also with the function about having a good social support system in the prison, to have, of course, instrumental that you, many of those prison officers are describing, they are almost laying their whole soul in this work. And when you first are thinking, oh, I need to have time as a free time and go to with my children to school and not go to work today, they can be met with a flexible attitude to change time when to go to work. So that's the instrumental dimension of the social support, but of course the affective and the camaraderie social support that is important to when you're working with such demanding prisoners, that the prison officers discuss and support another in a constructive and good way, so they feel they are a part of a big unit that working with such a demanding work.
Thank you.
Thanks very much, Knut. It's been a real pleasure meeting with you today, and thank you so much for sharing your paper with it. I look forward to the other ones being translated into English so that we can come back and talk to you about those.
Hopefully we come there, yeah.
Yeah, really, really fascinating. And I share David's observation that the paper's so well written. And yeah, as I said earlier, so much resonates in terms of the experiences that you hear from prison officers over here. It sounds, you know, you really see the familiarity of that role in this really high profile case.
So I thought we were very fortunate to have Knut with us today talking about this awful event, you know, because it's one of those events which makes one feel sad and full of dread, really, every time one thinks or hears about it. And so I think he's been very brave in going into this area to do his research. Of course, his research, as he described it, is focusing a lot upon the people who were involved at the time and just what a sort of terrifying situation it was. And what struck me was that it was a mega situation. It was a situation writ large. So we may have come across similar sorts of situations where we work. If you have a serious assault or an escape in a prison, it traumatizes the institution, and you can almost feel the effect that it's having. Whereas what Knut was describing really was a nation that was traumatized, and the fear that struck the nation from the very top levels down to people in the street.
It also really made me think about, you know, the human need to belong and how the officers that were working with this man really have been deprived of an ability to participate in kind of that national grieving because so are somehow prevented from belonging because they can't afford to get into their feelings about the act of terror because it would make the job so difficult to do. And, you know, what a burden that is to put on people, really.
Many thanks again to all of you who have listened to our Locked Up Living podcast. Feel free to mention this to your friends and to your colleagues and give us feedback on our webpage lockeduplives.com and our Twitter account Locked Up Living. Many thanks too to Pete and Rach, who kindly allowed us to use their music, You Have Called Me Courage, and this is available from all the usual outlets.